Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network, I am your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is General Kevin Lauderdale. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back.
Rob, stop me if you've heard this before. It is always a pleasure to work with you because you have both lilt and panache.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I like to think so. I could tell a good joke. So we're here to talk about the 12th episode of season 8, Dear Uncle Abdul. It originally aired on December 3rd, 1979. Of course, anyone who's listening to the show knows Kevin's been on the show every season, basically, since we started. So you're 3-star general, 4. I don't even know what rank of general you're at, but you've been here many times before. So we can jump right into the episode. So this episode opens with Klinger literally saying the words, "Dear Uncle Abdul," which makes it, I think, I mean, I don't have every, contrary to popular opinion, I don't have every episode committed to complete memory, but it is the only episode I can think of that opens with the title of the episode, right? There's been other episodes where they say the title, but I can't think of one that literally opens with the name of the episode, because, of course, most people didn't know the names of the episodes. They weren't listed outside of the finale. They weren't listed on screen, but... And it's kind of fitting in a weird way because this is the final Dear ... episode that MASH would do. They would do some variations on the format later on with Hawkeye writing a letter to Harry Truman and the letters episode. But this is the last classic Dear ... one. So, Kevin, why did you want to talk about this one?
Okay, everybody. Ready? Comfortable? Are you saying comfortably? Because this is going to be a long intro. And
don't tell people that, just say it.
Look, some of this may sound dry and academic and abstract, but before anybody out there says, "What you talking about, Kevin?" I say to you, don't have a cow man, because I have a cunning plan. This is one of my favorite episodes. It's a very funny episode. It's one of the ones I recorded the audio off of. I used to listen to it as a kid, and I thought I knew it, but it turns out there is so much more. I was watching it, and I had a thought. And I had another thought, and I had a whole cascade of epiphanies, if that's the collective noun. And I said to myself, okay, I could write all this down in like a 5,000 word essay and submit it to the American Journal of Popular Culture or whatever.
Is that a thing?
Or it might be. Or I could text Rob and say, hey, can I do this on MASHcast instead? And you said, yes. So you saved me. You saved me, Rob.
I like to all provide those, a service here with the show, yeah, yes.
All those footnotes I would have had to type up. No footnotes. I'm just going to do it on MASHcast. Okay. What really triggered this was about a year ago, I heard for the first time a very fancy word that is used in criticism of popular culture and art. Despite decades of life on this planet watching TV and movies and opera and radio shows, I never heard of this or its opposite. But I bet, Rob, I bet you know, because as we record this, you've just done your like 15th, 16th audio commentary for Cult Classic Cinemas.
Something like that, yeah.
You are noted film historian, Rob Kelly. Okay.
Thank you.
With that set up, tell the folks at home about diegetic and non-diegetic.
Okay, that's easy. Okay, so diegetic is just a term. You hear about it in movies, but it can be any piece of entertainment where the music that is playing, that the characters are hearing, is in the literal reality of the scenario. You know, we're hearing a song play, and it's coming over a radio. It's coming over television. That's old references. It's coming over somebody's phone, as opposed to non-diegetic music where it's a theme, it's a whatever, it's the Jaws theme playing in the background. So that's what diegetic music is. It's literally the characters are hearing it the way you're hearing it.
Exactly. In Star Wars, our characters walk into the cantina bar, they hear the music playing, that's diegetic music.
The light jazz.
They do not hear Luke's theme, Leia's theme, the Imperial March. 2 seconds after I heard this, I said to myself, oh my God, that means there is diegetic and non-diegetic comedy. That means there is stuff that the characters think is funny within their fictional universe that would be diegetic humor, and stuff that only we, the audience, think of as funny, as non-diegetic humor. And from here on out, when I say diegetic and non-diegetic, I'm referring to humor, despite the fact that this is an episode with four songs in it. Classic example, you're watching I Love Lucy. Lucy and Ethel are wrapping the candies. The conveyor belt goes faster and faster. That is non-diegetic comedy. They don't think that's funny at all. A great example of a diegetic episode of a TV show is that episode of MASH where everybody's telling a joke and they're trying to figure out who's the funniest person in camp. If you're telling a joke, it's as diegetic as it gets. Now, most sitcoms, that's the term we use, situation comedy, are non-diegetic. Very few characters are trying to be funny. Everyone on The Simpsons is dead serious, especially right. about going to Itchy and Scratchy Land. The humor comes from the characters, from the situations the characters find themselves in. Very few TV characters create humor. Okay, now at this point, I need to establish my comedy bona fides. just like when you have Dr. Ange on, because I really am a comedy writer. Nobody listening to this show will have read anything I've written. I don't write for TV shows or movies. I am, however, a, quote, real writer. I'm a member of SFWA, Science Fiction Writers Association, HWA, Horror Writers Association. I've written a whole bunch of short stories, various anthologies and things. One of the things I write are what I call the Reggie and James stories. These are my attempts to play with the voice and style of P.G. Wodehouse, the creator of Bertie Wooster and Jeeves. My characters are Reggie Brubaker and his personal gentleman's gentleman, James. Only what I do is I throw my characters into science fiction, fantasy, and horror situations. They're still comedies, but if Bertie Wooster was going to be called upon by his aunt to steal a silver cow creamer in their first adventure, Reggie was called upon by his aunt to steal the Necronomicon. In another one, Reggie is engaged to two women at once, but one is a vengeful fairy princess. In another one, Reggie accidentally promises his soul to the devil and James has to get it back for him. You get the point. I think what I'm going to try to do is put together a page. They'll have links to all of these things. I'm sure you can buy the anthologies for 99 cents each on Kindle, and I'll try to have a page ready when we're done. Anyway, as a comedy writer, I study story structure very carefully. I think that in comedy, structure is even more important than it is in drama, because comedy has to accomplish everything drama does, but backwards and in high heels. So my thesis, if you will, is this. MASH is highly diegetic. It is not the only diegetic show on television, but it is the most diegetic show on television, is my thesis. The creation of comedy is one of the most integral elements of MASH. These characters are trying to be funny. They are dealing with the stress of war through comedy. And in fact, a couple of sources have sort of accidentally clued themselves into this more than I think they understand. My family and I were once on vacation somewhere, and we're like a low rent hotel where the cable system is like, if you click the info button on the TV, it might say Star Trek, 1 hour, The Adventures of the Starship Enterprise, or something like that. We're watching MASH, and we clicked the info button, and it said, doctors in the Korean War blow off steam between surgeries. And I really think that's one of the key elements of MASH, using humor as a coping mechanism. There was another site, and its description of MASH was, during the Korean War, the staff of an army hospital find that humor helps to deal with difficulties. So this really can't be reinforced enough. Lots of shows have funny characters who do funny things and say funny things, but they're never trying to be funny. The intentional creation of humor and how integral it is to the characters is what makes MASH as a whole a show about humor and how it reflects the war and how humor is used as a coping mechanism. Now, lots of other shows have diegetic characters, but interesting, those are almost exclusively characters whose day job it is to be funny. A lot of times they're comedy writers, Liz Lemon, Mrs. Maisel, Rosemary, Maury Amsterdam.
Right. I was about to say the Dick Van Dyke show was the thing I thought of. Yeah,
exactly. Full House, Uncle Joey, his original job was a stand-up comedian, so it makes perfect sense for him to bust into a Popeye impression or start doing Bullwinkle references. What makes MASH so unique is none of the characters are professional comedians. It's completely unexpected for doctors in the Korean War to dress up in guerrilla outfits and drop one-liners. The sheer unexpectedness of MASH is what makes it so amazing. In case you doubt anybody's trying to be funny, Hawkeye asks Klinger at the very end of the episode, who's the funniest guy in this camp? Clearly, this is intentional. Okay, now, MASH is not the only Digex sitcom. Rob, I can think of another late 1970s TV show that I know you watched. Let's see how far down the rabbit hole we get before we come upon this, okay? So, 1970s TV show, comedy, with a very Diegetic character. Clue number one, guy with a mustache.
Welcome back, Cotter.
Very good.
Thank you.
For those of you at home who are very young, Welcome Back, Cotter starred Gabe Kaplan as Gabe Cotter, a social studies teacher in a tough inner city New York school, Brooklyn, fourth largest city in America. His way of connecting with his students, his way of teaching them, was to be diegetic, to impersonate Groucho Marx, to do one-liners, to do song parodies, to do jokes. Humor was his way of connecting with his students. There's lots of comedies set at schools, but the humor is incidental. The intentional creation of humor is a defining principle of the show. In fact, that show is so aggressively diegetic. Rob, how did every episode begin?
It began.
So
with him telling a joke to his wife, right? Wasn't it? Is that the
my memory is it was the beginning because he tells the joke and I can hear in my mind bum 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 ba dum bum.
So I have not seen Welcome Back, Cotter in decades. So you could be completely right. I know that was an element that he would tell Marcia Strassman, who of course was on MASH in the first season, a joke every time. Yes.
Literally opened with a joke. For our British listeners, this is like the end of episodes of Vicar of Dibley, where Geraldine tells Alice jokes. So here's my first realization. MASH is television's most diegetic show. And this, of course, is the most diegetic episode because it's about a joke. And then I had more thoughts. Wow. This is a Dear Blank episode, as we say. The producers have told us whenever they had an idea for a plot they couldn't flesh out or just a scene or just one joke, they'd put it up on the bulletin board. Okay, we don't know if there was actually a bulletin board, but they would save it. When they had enough, they put them together as a Dear Blank episode. So a lot of people don't care for these episodes because, quote, nothing happens. Well, that's not this joke. That's not this episode. Yes, there's a lot going on, and not only does it all converge, and it pays off, and more importantly, it's almost as if the writers of MASH couldn't help but do a great job. This episode is actually a masterclass in television comedy writing. And as we go through this, I'm going to point out all the little elements. There is a story. It's the lowest stakes conflict and drama you will ever encounter, but it's there. And I'm going to point out little writer and little TV tricks as we go along. At the end of this episode of MASH Cast, you should all put down your pen and say, I'm going to go be a television writer. So as we talk tonight, we may veer off the road to Wee John Boo a little. But we're
too late for that.
It's all going to come back to MASH. Coming back to MASH and this episode. So, Rob, thank you for having me. Everybody, thank you for coming and listening to my Paley Center presentation.
I mean, I like the Deer episodes. I don't know. Did they get a bad rap by some fans? I don't know. They're tales of the 4/7/7th episodes. I always like these episodes, and I was going to say, and I've said this on other episodes, like, it is criminal that Margaret never got one. I don't know how they didn't do that for a character that was, other than Hawkeye, the only character that was on all 11 seasons. She never got one is just beyond me. I wonder, like, the late great Loretta Swit, did she, you know, When they gave one to like the visiting Korean spy, was she like, what the hell? Like, what's Margaret getting a Dear episode? Like, what is this about? So
where's my Dear Donald episode? Yeah.
Yeah. Anything at all. It's so strange to me that she never got one. But so anyway, yes, this is the final Dear ... episode. And so, okay. So now you wanted.
It's not
you,
random. There are strings, there are paths through this episode.
Okay.
We're going to tackle him.
Yep. So it opens with Klinger typing a letter, as we talked about, just said to his dear Uncle Abdul in his typewriter. And he mentions that everyone is bored because there's a ceasefire. And then a guy comes in and opens the door and says, hey, we've got wounded. And Klinger's like, there's a ceasefire. How did anybody get wounded? Now, you told me you wanted me to stop before we get to the OR scene. We're at the OR scene. So okay, Kevin, what's up?
Klinger's at his typewriter. This episode states its thesis right off the bat. Klinger tells a joke. Then he says, I'm busier than the one-armed paper hanger. Then he says, get it? Which is what you say after you've told a joke. Then he says, but seriously, which is what you say as a stand-up comic to clear the space for your next joke. So straight off the bat, this is going to be a episode about jokes and about telling jokes. Those three things are also the three acts of the show. Tell the joke, get it, discussion about the joke, trying to figure out who tells it best. And then finally, of course, how does this episode end? But seriously, folks.
Interesting. I am. Okay. I didn't think about that. All right. Okay. All right.
So this episode is not going to be incidentally funny. The writers know what they're doing. They're hammering it from jump.
Okay. Well, that's true of every episode, but okay.
Okay.
So let's give the description here. So after the surgery scene, Father Mulcahy gets involved. There's various doings going on at the 477 that Klinger writes about. Father Mulcahy gets involved in writing an inspirational war song. Winchester drags Klinger out into the brush to use him to help flush out wild game. And Margaret, enraged that Army Supply won't issue her a new footlocker unless it's damaged in combat, goes ahead and shoots up her old one using Winchester's hunting rifle. Meanwhile, Hawkeye and BJ get in a debate about who's funnier. It gets kicked off when Hawkeye tells BJ an old joke that he learned from his dad. But BJ doesn't think it's that funny, walking away from Hawkeye dismissively with, see you later, Uncle Milty. Hawkeye is annoyed to no end when he learns that BJ is going around the camp telling the same joke, getting laughs and the credit. But the debate is tabled for the moment when a young soldier named Eddie wanders into camp looking for his pal Hank, who is wounded and recovering in the 477's post-op. Another member of the unit mentions that Eddie is what they call a little slow, not mentally retarded, but simply not all that bright. Hawkeye and BJ are shocked and disgusted that someone like that has been put into combat. There's an even bigger problem. Eddie's pal Hank is scheduled to be shipped home, leaving Eddie behind. Things get patched up when Hank reassures Eddie that he's tough and a good soldier, and he'll be fine. Their mutual friend Dave steps in and promises to become Eddie's new best pal now that Hank is leaving. The debate about who's funnier resumes, and Hawkeye and BJ ask Klinger for his opinion. Klinger offers the answer is neither of them. In a unit with a priest who writes war ditties, a head nurse that shoots luggage, and a major that likes to dress up and go quail hunting, what's so special about two guys going around telling jokes? Klinger, Klinger ends his letter admitting to his Uncle Abdul that he now understands why he never got a Section 8. There's nothing special about me. Everybody here is crazy. All right. So, again, we already talked about the opening, and then there is the scene in post-op. What we're talking about, where Potter explains how everyone feels compelled to start shooting when things get nervous, and then Klinger takes a letter for Hawkeye, which he starts with, "Dear dummies, a ceasefire means firing ceases," and that leads to Hawkeye saying that only happens in wars. This is a police action. And that leads Potter to say, "I've been in a couple wars. This feels like a war." And then they get into a discussion about a kind of meta discussion of they don't really fully understand why they're here. It's not like World War I or World War II where the mission was clear. And then that kind of leads to Father Mulcahy going on and deciding to write a war song, because Potter mentions that there are no inspirational war songs. And it's kind of funny in that the show, I don't think the show is meaning to do this, or maybe it, I don't know, maybe I'm not giving enough credit. Maybe it is, but you know, if you want to talk geopolitics, it's because this was the first war that was a proxy war that America was fighting. It was we're fighting another country, but we're using another country to fight that other country because we're not doing it directly. And that's why this war feels different. It's different than World War II, which was we're literally stopping the Nazis. This one is a little different. So I don't know. The MASH writers were pretty sophisticated guys. I don't know if they were trying to make a larger point about it necessarily, or just using maybe the research they got from veterans of the war and maybe thought the same thing. But yeah, and of course, Korea became known as the Forgotten War to a lot of people because it was so soon after World War II, and America was like, again, we're fighting, you know, after World War II, we're fighting again. So that's all that in this melange of this one scene.
It's the serious part of the all comedy fest episode. If I were writing an essay, I would have to go try to find my copy of J. Michael Straczynski's Complete Book of Scriptwriting. Because I don't want to do that, I'm simply going to assert, I believe in J. Michael Straczynski's Complete Book of Scriptwriting. He says something like, every episode is somebody's first episode. So when your characters come in, they should be talking about and doing the sorts of things that those characters do, even if they're not particularly germane to the plot. This episode and this scene, if you've never seen that match before, at the end of this scene, you know two very important things about Hawkeye and BJ. You know they are competitive,
yep.
And you know they are funny. And even more so, they're competitive about being funny. Every scene with those two characters in this episode will reinforce that. I want to talk about the songs. So first of all, a lot of people might be thinking, what are these songs? These are World War I era songs. How legit, Rob, is it, do you think, that in the 1950s, people would know World War I era songs so well, they'd be able to riff on them and do quick pop culture, you know, parodies of them in an instant? And also, how legit is it, do you think, that in the late 70s, the audience at home would recognize these songs?
That's a bigger leap. I would definitely figure that these guys knew, because you think about it, this is like 1950, well, whatever year it is, 51, 52. Yeah. Let's say it's 1951, 52. BJ and Hawkeye are 30. That means they're born in 1922, which means they're right after World War I. So those songs were in the pop. I mean, I knew these songs. I knew that, and probably this because I watched old movies, but I think it's legit that they would know those kind of old songs.
Well, certainly the writers knew those songs. I mean, thinking of the series finale of Mary Tyler Moore, it ends with everybody singing
Long Way to Tipperary, yeah.
The Long Way to Tipperary, a World War I era song. I do want to talk about these two songs very briefly, because the first one is, how are you going to keep them down the farm after they've seen Perry, is the original song. And that's basically Radar's grandmother's lament about Radar's Uncle Ed.
Right.
Your son has gone off to... My uncle came back because mother took one look at him and could tell he hadn't been a good boy.
Right. That's right.
After your son has gone off to France, the song is about, pardon me, a couple. After the son has gone off to France and fought and experienced life, he's not going to want to go work behind a plow anymore, is what that song is about. Mademoiselle from Armentier, Parlez-vous, is about a French prostitute. Sample lyric. She's the hardest working girl in town. She makes her living upside down. Parlez-vous. What's funny is the phrase parlez-vous, which if you took high school French, is simply, do you speak? Parlez-vous anglais? Do you speak English? Parlez-vous français? Do you speak French? That phrase got disconnected from any really meaning. It became its own idiomatic expression for, you know, do you want to get it on, basically? In fact, one of the lines in How Are You Going to Keep Them Down the Farm is, you can't parlez-vous a cow, to which I can only say, thank God. You know, to paraphrase Tom Lehrer, talk about animal husbandry. But
that was three references deep of obscure stuff.
but anyway, so what's important is these are funny guys. They intentionally create song parodies. They are practitioners of diegetic comedy. And you know what they did right there? Hawkeye didn't say, oh, let me get back to you in 30 minutes with a really good, funny song parody. They did it right there. So they're fast and they're funny. Now, this scene also introduces Chekhov's mustache. Right? Hawkeye says BJ has a funny mustache. It's not seen, but it's referred to. It will be back. And as a side note, is anyone else distracted by the foot that is right in front of BJ's face as he's performing surgery? I guess he's working on the patient's knee or something. I'm looking.
It's a curious choice, right? To have him have that, you know, why, as opposed to just standing up and doing what he's normally doing. But yeah.
So let's move on to Sophie.
Okay. So next, Klinger is in the middle of writing his letter, and he gets interrupted by Colonel Potter, who says Sophie's at her best right now. And they run outside, and we see that he is doing a painting, and he is using Klinger as his model. And Klinger is wearing Colonel Potter's, you know, dress uniform. And then he mentions that he says, I'm using you as a model, and I will paint in my own lovable face, or handsome and lovable face later. And he comments to Klinger. He's like, put out your back or something. He's like,
stick out your chin. I am sticking out my chin.
Then suck in that nose, which is.
This had to have been a bulletin board idea. What if Potter is painting a self-portrait and he needs Klinger as his body?
Yeah.
And that's it. We get a lovely shot of Klinger in a dress uniform. Not everything is gold from the bulletin board. I mean, this does pan out as yet another element for the very end as to why things are crazy here. And they're using the Paramount Ranch to its fullest extent. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous day. I imagine they probably spent 2 or 3 hours waiting to get just this scene, but it's beautiful.
Oh, he says, my own hard-bitten but lovable face. I love describing himself as hard-bitten but lovable, which is, I'd say that's pretty accurate description of Colonel Potter.
Oh, yeah.
So then we go to the O Club, and Hawkeye is reading this letter from his dad, and he starts laughing. Now, why? Why is the bar on the other side of the O Club this time? Why? I don't know why they decided to set this, that the bar is always on the fourth wall, and we are behind the bartender, so the guys can lean on the bar and be facing the camera. And this time they decided to just move the bar to the far wall and have them sitting there with their backs to the camera. And I'm like, why? Why did they choose to do that for this episode?
I can think of only one reason, and it just popped into my mind at this moment. One of the things I was going to say is, never forget, television is a visual medium. So anytime you can show your characters doing something different, that's great. In this scene and later on, our characters are moving, they're flying, they're creating the illusion of flight. Hawkeye flies around. Maybe when they were setting this up, things were in the way and they had to reconstruct the set in order to give Hawkeye lots and lots of room to fly around and move his body and things
maybe.
I'm not a director, I don't know.
Yeah, it's just unusual, right? It's like you just all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, why is the bar there? So Hawkeye starts telling this joke and he's laughing uncontrollably and he's like, you know, don't get mad at me if you fall off the bar stool and break your clavy. And BJ's like, don't, you know, just tell me the joke, you know. Now Hawkeye is overselling this joke by a few fair fathoms. I mean, it's okay. It's an old joke. It's definitely a joke that a dad would tell. It's something I could imagine in another life Dr. Ange would tell this joke. Do I laugh at it? No. Would you laugh at it if you were a kid in 1928 and your dad was telling it to you? Yeah, probably. But Hawkeye is doing the joke no favors by making it sound like it's the funniest thing in the world. And the thing I always think about when there's like the idea of like somebody overselling something is one of my favorite movies of all time is Citizen Kane. It is genuinely one of my all-time favorite movies. I've seen it in the theater like half a dozen times already. And the worst thing that's ever happened in that movie is being stuck with the tag, it's the greatest movie of all time, because there are people who just don't want to see it now because it sounds like homework. And it's not homework. That movie is fun and funny and thrilling and all sorts of things. And it doesn't matter that it's, you know, technically one of the greatest movies ever made, but it's been tagged with that. And it gives people kind of a chip on their shoulder of like, oh, all right, Citizen Kane, you better be. And Hawkeye is just massacring any chance this joke is going to be funny by going on and on about it, to the point where, like I just said, BJ gets even almost like slightly irritated, you know, where he's like, just tell it to me, you know? So
that said, I want to run the numbers on this joke.
Okay.
I want to see if on paper, this joke is funny. So number one, it begins with the magic phrase, this guy,
right?
Rob, what movie taught us to always begin a joke with this guy?
Oh, I don't know.
My Favorite Year. Benji
Stone. Oh, that's right. Casey, that's, oh, I haven't seen that.
This
in
guy.
A
so it
while,
begins with the phrase, this guy. That said, if I have any complaints about the joke, it's the opening. This guy character is supposed to be the guy who comes in. This joke should not begin, this guy owns Big Top and he's walking around, the skinny guy comes in. The joke should begin, this skinny guy comes into a circus big tent, says he wants to see the owner.
Anyway,
this joke is not a rule of three joke. This happens, that happens, then the twist. And I think that's really great for television, because that way, if someone wasn't paying attention, if someone comes in, it's just a straight linear joke. This. If somebody wasn't, they're like, wait, was it the Italian guy who wished for the snowmobile from the genie, or the Irish guys? I don't, no, straight joke. So none of that, perfectly clean. Pardon me.
Go ahead. Yeah, no, you go ahead.
I was gonna say, I got a lot more. So if you've got a comment about that, lean in.
No, go right ahead.
Okay. Next element. Jokes end in failure. Just a reminder, success is never funny. Charlie Brown kicking the football is not funny. If the circus owner at the end had said, oh my God, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen, here's a contract for $100,000, nobody would care. Now, I want to know, because I know a lot of your listeners are sort of first-time MASH viewers, do they think this joke is funny? And more importantly, for non-native speakers of English, do you get this joke? Because the punchline is the guy flies and the circus owner says, that's all you do, bird imitations. And it hinges on the idea of bird imitations. I mean, a lot of our younger listeners, I want to point out that bird imitating was a legitimate form of entertainment into the early 1900s. You would go to a vaudeville show, which was an early form of variety, and on the bill, along with all the singers, dancers, acrobats, and clowns, it might say, you know, George Washman, bird imitations. And he would sit there and go, the French wren. People would go, oh my God, that is the French wren. That's amazing. Or, you know, the blue-footed warbler. People would say, oh my God, that sounds just like the blue-footed warbler. That's incredible. I don't know if that form of entertainment survived the transition into television, but I will say this. A quick Google search on bird imitators tells us that as late as April of 2025, 10-year-old boy in England successfully defended his title. This was his second victory in the European Community Goal Screeching Contest. So people are still out there imitating birds.
Wow. It is amazing to think of, like, what, you know, passed for entertainment 50 years ago, like, in terms of just what was something screamingly funny. And a lot of it is, you look back on it now and you're just kind of like, what? Like, what? You know, kind of, some stuff ages well and some stuff doesn't. There's been some stuff that's like considered classically funny, and I watch it and I go, this isn't what? I don't understand why this is funny at all. And I have the same reaction that BJ has when Hawkeye finishes the joke, which is the, like, and you know that he's kind of humoring his friend because, you know, he doesn't even think it's that funny. And so I kind of love that just thing that Hawkeye does, that BJ does. And then, of course, BJ, I keep saying flipping names. Hawkeye is horrified. And then, of course, he does the bird flapping again as if BJ didn't understand the joke. And it's like, give it up. This is not good.
I'm flying. The guy is flying. Perhaps you don't get this, BJ. No,
I love what he says. Cute. You call the funniest joke in the world of cute. That's like saying Ava Gardner has pleasant features, which I like. I do like. I do enjoy that as the comparison there. And then of course BJ gives him the most ultimate dismissive response, where he's like, "I hate to smirk and run, but I'm doing push-ups. See you later, Uncle Milty."
Milton Berle Television's first and preeminent television comedy star,
right,
of the 1950s. Yeah,
but I love that it's meant to be dismissive, of like, okay, yeah, we have your Mr. Comedy over here. So Hawkeye is left with sort of nothing to do, and then he goes and he talks to Mulcahy, and Mulcahy is talking about that he is composing a war ditty, and he's kind of really, really involved in it. And he starts writing this song, and the gist of this, much like the joke, that the joke, Hawkeye thought the joke was funny, and it isn't, to BJ, that this song isn't very good. That's the idea, because, like, at one point, Hawkeye kind of rolls his eyes a little. I actually think it's not bad. I think he's like, it's no Halls of Montezuma, but he goes, no, but it rhymes a lot. I don't know. I actually thought it wasn't too bad. I thought, as you know, for just a couple of bars of a song, I thought it was relatively okay. He's just not a great singer.
Yeah, it's catchy and upbeat, but failure is funny. If Hawkeye said, that is amazing, that is a great song.
Well, right. I get why, that. Yes. Yeah, I get why it doesn't work
but
for
you're
the
right.
show.
Song qua song. Yeah, it's a catchy little upbeat thing. It could be turned into a butter jingle. Or, you know, you could sell cars with it or something like that.
I thought it was fairly clever about the idea that the girl sends her photo to her GI boyfriend and he puts it in the scope of his rifle. I actually like, I don't know. It's kind of evocative. Even when I was a kid, I was like, I don't know. Was that bad? I didn't think it was that bad, but okay, that's fine.
It's very in the same vein as the other World War One songs.
It very much is. Yes, that is true. So then Hawkeye goes to the mess tent and he finds Potter laughing uncontrollably about something. And he starts telling, he says, I heard me a doozy this morning. And every time I start thinking about it, I start busting my slats, which is, again, wonderfully old-timey phrase. So he starts telling the joke. And then just as he's telling the joke, Klinger comes in and he's like, oh, what's so funny? And then Potter says, well, I can regale two of you just as easily as one. And then they start getting into the joke. And I love that shot of Hawkeye the minute he figures out that it's the joke. He looks so unpleased, so unhappy. And he's just like, a little scrotum guy comes into the circus, right? I love how mad he gets about it.
When you were growing up among your circle of friends, was there someone who was the funny one, or was it you? Were you the funny one?
In high school, there was one friend of mine that it all depends on your point of view. I thought there were two of us. I thought it was me and this other friend.
Just like you, it's like Hawkeye and BJ. Mm.
A little bit. And I was, I have to admit, I'm not proud to admit this. It's been a long time ago, but that irritated me a little bit. I thought I had a different kind of sense of humor and I thought it was equally interesting. And that was not necessarily the entire, I could make him laugh, right? I could make him laugh. And then he would kind of make the others in the group kind of laugh. And so I was almost like, you know, the joke whisperer kind of thing. But I didn't tell joke. We didn't tell jokes. That's another kind of antiquated form of comedy. You know what I mean? Like if you ask me now, tell me a joke, I'd be hard pressed to tell you one. I don't know if I know any because I don't know of ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. I just know of, you know, that's not way people, I think, relate comedy anymore other than stand-up comedians.
That's interesting. Later on, we'll get to one of my favorite lines, which is, you created that wondrous anecdote. It's like, no, but I own the North Korean rights to it. Yeah, I've never created a joke, despite the fact that I've written, you know, comedy stories. Those are not jokes. Every joke I have ever told, I heard from somebody else. Who is creating these wondrous anecdotes? Where are these jokes coming from when we were 5 and 6 years old or whatever? You know, they came maybe from joke books. Everything was passed down. Oral tradition in the schoolyard. But I don't know anybody who's I've never sat down. I just came up with a joke. Check it out. Blah, 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 blah. No.
Yeah, I've never. Yeah.
Where do jokes come from?
Do you have a favorite joke though? Do you have like a single one that you could point to that you're just like, oh man, that I love that. It doesn't make you laugh anymore because you've already heard it 10 million times, but it's in terms of you talk about it, you're a writer. In terms of joke construction, is there some joke that you just, you know, you're like, oh, I've always loved that one?
Well, I'll tell you, it's not the world's funniest clean joke, but I do have a joke which a couple of times a year, something will happen. I will be reminded of this. And like Charles, in just a few minutes, I will sort of wander off chortling to myself. And sure, I'll tell it. It's very simple. This guy's walking down the street and he bumps into an old friend of his. He goes, oh my God, Ray, I haven't seen you in years. He's like, look at you. Let's face it, you used to be kind of fat, but nice and slim. Been working out, buddy. And you used to be a slob, but look at you. Nice clothes, must be doing well. And hey, let's face it, used to be bald, got implants. Hey, no shame there. The other guy goes, my name's not Ray, it's Ralph. The first guy goes, you even changed your name.
That's a dad joke. That's a very dead trick.
I hope I told her because I don't remember what name I used at the very beginning.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you said different names. I get it. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
It's just that just charms me.
Okay.
It just sort of charms me. I'm not going to sell that as the world's funniest clean joke.
Okay.
Every now, like a couple of times a year, something will happen. I'll just go, yeah, just like, and I'll just laugh.
Okay. All right.
do you have?
I will say I like jokes that you have to piece together yourself. And those I have two that I really love. One is the classic one. A lot of people have heard of, which is it's one line. Other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
Yeah.
I love that joke because you have to know, and I like that it's not set up punchline. It's just one sentence and it's just the whole idea. My all-time favorite joke is from the comedian Shecky Green, who told a joke where he said, Frank Sinatra saved my life one night. He said, "Okay, boys, he's had enough."
Oh, jeez.
I'm laughing at it now. I love that joke because, again, you have to know the reputation of Frank Sinatra. If you don't, then it's probably not funny at all. But I've always loved that joke of just the idea that he's getting credit for saving his life by stopping the violence that he has himself started. I've always found that joke to be very funny. So
our younger listeners and our foreign listeners probably won't get either of those jokes.
No.
At all. No, and in fact, anybody younger than us probably won't.
Right. Even jokes. Right. My two jokes are involving Abe Lincoln and Frank Sinatra. It's right there. It's not exactly current, but okay. So speaking of jokes, Hawkeye goes to the host goes to a post-op, and what do we see? BJ telling the joke to the entire post-op, including the nurses and Winchester, who finds it improbably funny. Winchester's sense of humor is, we find out, a little unusual. In season 10, we'll find out that he likes Freddy guy who you wouldn't think he would like. And then in season 11, we find out that he loves Tom and Jerry. So he's capable of finding some lowbrow stuff funny. And of course, Hawkeye is incensed, and he introduces himself. "Hey, you remember me as your joke writer?" So I think Hawkeye, like kind of what you were talking about earlier, Hawkeye's just incensed at the idea that he has provided the joke and he's getting no credit. I think he's more bothered by that than anything else, that BJ is going around pretending that he sort of wrote it.
That's some great dialogue in there. Like, again, you created that wondrous anecdote, says Charles. "No, but I own the North Korean rights to it." I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Charles is such a delight in this. We rarely see him laugh at anything. And to see something that sort of tickles his funny bone, he sort of walks away chortling, repeating the punchline. It's almost like he's leaving a Broadway musical humming a tune.
Mm. And he walks away and he's like retelling the joke to himself and stuff like that. So, yeah. So they're having this conversation. Meanwhile, Klinger shows up and says there's someone here looking for help. And it's a infantryman. And they even say, we don't, we always say hi to someone who's carrying an active firepower or whatever the sentence is. I'm not remembering it right. That is the character is Eddie, played by Richard Lineback. This is his first of two MASHes. He would come back in the Trick or Treatment episode. He did a lot of TV, Lou Grant, The Waltons, T.J. Hooker, Knight Rider, various episodes of Star Trek and things like that. And he comes in and they immediately figure out that he's not exactly, I don't want to say right. That's kind of pejorative, but he's just, Klinger refers to him as a little confused. And they're asking, like, what are you looking for? And it says he's looking for Hank. And he says, "I'm supposed to go wherever he goes." And they're trying to figure out who that might be. And then finally they hear someone yell out for Eddie. And that is one of his fellow soldiers, Dave, played by the actor Kelly Ward, who was in a war movie, a really good war movie with Mark Hamill called The Big Red One, which is a Sam Fuller movie, which is not that well known, but it's actually really, really quite effective. And then he went on to a very long career doing behind the scenes work at Disney. If you look him up on IMDb, he's got dialogue director credits as long as your arm, and a lot of voiceover work. So how he found his way to that, I don't know, but I guess he gave up acting and then just went behind the scenes, and he's like working to this day for Disney doing their animated shows, their live action shows and stuff like that. So he kind of had a interesting career path. And then Dave and Eddie are talking, and then they finally figure out who he's referring to when he's referring to Hank. And BJ says, oh, Corporal Fleming. And he says, he's unconscious, but he's going to be fine. And they realize he's got shrapnel in his neck. And they talk about the fact that Hank and Eddie are very close. And Dave mentions that Eddie is just, as he says, just a little slow. And Hawkeye and BJ are kind of like, you know, wait, what? And then BJ even says, are you saying he's got some sort of mental problem? And Dave's like, no, Eddie's fine. He's just not as smart as everybody else. And he says, as long as he hangs around, stays around with Hank, he's fine. And then they reveal, well, the problem with that is Hank is scheduled to go home. And that is our act break. So for a very silly episode, now we've got something very serious dropped into the middle of it.
In this scene, we get our second reference to BJ's mustache, and we get to see it right now. I want to give a brief shout out to the guys at the Script Notes podcast, which is a podcast about things of interest to TV and movie writers. So sometimes it's industry news, but a lot of it is story structure and things like that. And they pointed out something a while back, which is, not surprisingly, there are good setups and bad setups. A bad setup just sort of lies there. A good setup serves its own purpose within the scene. And this episode for me is, it might as well have been called the mustache episode, because all these little things about mustaches finally come to their culmination at the very end in the button scene. But what if your syndicator had cut the button scene at the end? And there are only just a couple of random references to mustaches, but it doesn't actually get a payoff at the end. Well, that's okay, because the writers here are doing a very good job. Hawkeye and BJ fight about the mustache a little bit. There's a callback here. Hawkeye had been a little snide about the mustache in the OR scene, and BJ is sort of calling him out on it. Even if the mustache was never mentioned again, the stuff works within the scene. And it also serves to reinforce the tension between Hawkeye and BJ over their competitiveness. And maybe you as a casual viewer haven't really noticed the mustache. You know, like you might not notice someone's glasses or their hairstyle, or maybe you've been watching MASH so long you become
just used to it at this point. Yeah,
exactly. You don't really see it anymore. And in my imagination, is it my imagination or does it look particularly full and shaggy in this episode? Anyway, this episode is all a setup for the final button scene and the reveal of Hawkeye's mustache.
You're giving it away, Kev.
Oh, well, spoilers for it. What year is this? 1981?
79.
Anyway, 1979. From my point of view, the whole episode leads up to the button scene and the mustache. So with all this stuff leading up to something so small, again, comedy, all this stuff starting big, ending small. I love this scene because we get to see one of my favorite things, which is intense Klinger. Klinger worried. I love the Dreams episode when Klinger is saying there he's so concerned about what's going on with Charles. Jamie Farr has such an incredibly expressive face.
Yes, he does.
And I got a hot take, which is I think that of Gary Burkoff, Bill Christopher, and Jamie Farr, Farr might be the best actor. And maybe it's because all the characters get dramatic turns over the course of the series. But I think Klinger has the widest range of material. Perhaps he gets more exposure. I mean, pretty much every Father Mulcahy line kind of is delivered the same way. But even within this episode, Farr gets like three or four different deliveries to do with things. It's all a super cozy, low-stakes drama. But Farr is there being like, you're saying there's something wrong with this kid? And you see those eyes, and he's just... I love watching Jamie Farr when he's being intense and serious.
Mm-hmm. He was capable of a lot, you know, and outside of MASH, I don't think he got a lot of opportunity to do very much. And you could argue that's because some of the choices he made outside of his career, but maybe that was all he got offered. But I say all the time, after MASH, despite its reputation as one of the greatest creative failures in the history of television, was not that bad. And there was potential there that just was not realized, but there was potential there. And I think they didn't you know, instead the network panicked and put Klinger back in a dress in season two, which is just the saddest damn thing imaginable. Yeah. But so anyway, I like that this episode is so silly, and then it drops this thing in there of like, oh wow, this is a real thing. You know, this is a real problem of like, this kid probably shouldn't be in combat. And then Dave is very, you know, like, no, he's good. He talks about that. He's a good soldier. You know, he got Hank like out of the harm's way and got him onto a litter, you know, got him onto a Jeep and whatever. And, you know, it doesn't sound ideal, but you're like, well, maybe this kid isn't bad. He just can't be in command or anything like that. But of course, pairing him up with someone and making his, survival based on being able to hang out with one guy. Well, that doesn't work because what happens if this thing that has happened happens? Is that Hank gets wounded and he's going to have to go home. So that is a bit of a problem. So again, that is our act break. And so it's a nice turn that for such a silly show, then they drop this issue that's really not been addressed before into the show.
And the director even gives us a slow zoom in on Hawkeye as he's saying it.
Yeah.
So it's like emphasizing the drama.
Day after tomorrow, Hank goes home. So now we're back to Klinger writing his letter when he's interrupted by Margaret, who is wondering why she cannot get a new footlocker. And Klinger reads the rule book. And he says, I-Corps says they'll only replace a footlocker if it's damaged in combat, which makes no sense. That just like, what are you talking? Like,
well, if you drop it.
You know, yeah, I mean, does that mean anyone who is not literally fighting in combat doesn't ever get anything replaced? That makes no sense. That, you know, but of course it's meant to be the army. It doesn't, it's a catch 22 kind of thing. It makes no sense. So
right.
She's,
and it, I was gonna say, it sets things up for us. Klinger delivers the news in a sort of bored manner, and we, the viewers, aren't really inclined to pay attention. Army red tape, yada, yada, yada. I heard it before. If you are paying attention, something's gonna happen. If the only possible comedic solution is X, and you're in a place where there is no X, what is going to happen? In fact, again, Klinger has a great one-liner. He says, oh, I got a hope chest I'm not using anymore. I don't think young ladies have hope chests anymore in the 19th, early 20th century. As a girl grew up, she would slowly acquire many of the things she would need to take into her future ranch house when she married her future aerodynamics engineer husband. So imagine the thrill of turning 16 and receiving for your birthday a full set of linen dining room textiles with the promise that maybe at Christmas you get the accompanying silver napkin rings, you know. All the chattel you'll need when you're married.
So in the middle of this fight, Winchester comes in his hunting attire, which means it's like a big red coat with his hat. And I love Margaret's response. What the hell are you supposed to be? She's just so like, what? She does not sugarcoat it, right? She's just like, what the hell are you made up to be? And of course, you know, he's talking about this is the finest hunting wear from wherever it is that he got it from.
Oh, it's Abercrombie and Fitch.
Oh, of course. And of course it is.
Today, that's where teenage girls buy crop top Nirvana t-shirts. But I mean, in the 1890s to the 1980s, it was an outfitter. It's where Teddy Roosevelt and Ernest Hemingway bought supplies for their African safaris. And again, something visually different, something not, you know, not all of drab. What's the episode? What? It's red. It's anti-green. The one where everything is dyed red. Yeah. So again, something visually interesting for us to see. Oh yeah. We're going to talk about Margaret's reaction later on. I've got notes, but I do want to point out Margaret has no time for Charles' BS.
I also love, I was going to say, I just love that Winchester has also pinned
His major's clusters.
His clusters or his oak leaves or whatever he's got. Is it the oak leaf? Right. It's the oak leaf, right? I believe it's the oak leaf. Whatever it is. His major insignia onto the coat and his hat. Because, like, who doesn't know who he is in the camp? But he has to do it because he's Winchester.
My favorite comedy duo in MASH is Charles and Klinger.
Yes.
Because they're both the most dissimilar, but also the most similar. They're both out for their own best interests constantly. One is from the upper echelon, one is from the lower. And so while the two clash frequently, they also mesh in weird and twisted ways.
They're a classic comedy team of opposites. Yeah. And of course, you know, Winchester respects Klinger for his ingenuity and getting things that he needs, you know, whether it's cognac or whatever and stuff. Like, he doesn't want to know about it, but he respects it. So yeah, they have a great comedic rhythm. So we're back in a post-op, and now we're talking to the aforementioned Hank, who has now woken up. He's played by actor Alexander Patali. I'm not sure exactly how he said that. He only had a couple of TV credits outside of this dynasty, Heart to Heart. And we say he's got a throat wound, which is why he's kind of talking like this. And then Hawkeye gives him the nudes where he says, you're going home. And he's like, oh, I love being able to tell people that. And Eddie is asleep next to him, and then he wakes him up, and they have this conversation. And he says, you know, I know I'm a dummy. And Hank is like, you're not a dummy. You're tough. You're good. You know, and it's very sweet, right? You can forget about the horribleness of this. This kid probably should not be in combat. It is really sweet that this Hank guy dotes on him so much. And he's like, you know, no, you're not a dummy. You're tough. You're good. You're good at what you do. You know, you saved my life and things like that. So that's a really sweet scene between these two.
I'm glad he's not a one note joke, which it could have been. It's super cozy between Eddie and Hank. I'm glad we have now in the 20th century a sort of a new sitcom shorthand for people cooperating and trying to help each other. I would say this is a Ted Lasso-esque sort of a subplot for all its drama. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad to see things like that.
So then we're out in the woods, and Klinger is helping Winchester flush out some game. And he literally recites some of the letter out loud, which is just for the benefit of the audience, because he's not like he's writing it down, but he's just doing it to sort of like practicing in his head what he's going to write. And Winchester sees this bird, and Klinger does this whole kind of like a spaniel thing where he goes and he flushes the game out. Winchester shoots at it. He hits the bird. The bird falls, thanks to some B-roll that we've got, because it looks the footage is grainy. It looks like it was shot for a National Geographic special in like 1962 or something. It falls and causes an explosion, which means it probably hit a land. He says that bird either hit a landmine or you just shot down a kamikaze pigeon. He gets up and he's like, I don't care what you say, I'm getting out of here. And he points to where he thinks Winchester is, which is where he saw Winchester the last time. And then we pan over and we see that Winchester is already running.
He's not stupid.
It's a great visual gag, the way the camera slides over. And we see that Winchester is a good quarter mile away from where he was a second ago. I like all that. That's funny. That's funny stuff. It's the wrong outfit to wear that far out from the camp, because it is decidedly not camouflage. In fact, you would be easily shot at by an enemy soldier in that bright red, but Winchester's not worrying about that, I guess.
Oh, that's a good point. The whole point of that is so your fellow hunters don't accidentally shoot you, but when you're out in the combat situation, it only draws the attention of the North Koreans.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah. So then we're back at the compound, and Dave and Eddie and Hank are talking. Actually, it's this scene where he talks about, where he says, you just know me, I'm a dummy. And he says, you're not a dummy, you're tough, you're good. And then Dave says, besides, you're not going to be alone from now on. You and I are buddies. And, you know, you have to think about, like, that's such an enormous thing to take on, right? You're out there worrying about you're going to get shot, and you're having to worry about your friend. And now you have to kind of like dote on this guy a little bit. And it's just a huge responsibility. And it's like, I don't know who their commander is, but he really should not be. These guys should not have to be taking on this responsibility.
Yeah, I know it's the whole band of brothers thing, but if you're given special consideration that you have to like focus, it's almost like this is the one guy under your command and you're only a private or something like that.
They talk about that. That's the reason why they don't want priests and medics necessarily out there in the field, or reporters or something, because they don't have weapons. And now it's like, well, now I got to worry about you getting shot. Now, this kid is a soldier, but nevertheless, you know, it is a little like, okay, this is a big thing to take on. So anyway, they tell Hawkeye that they've set it up and that when Dave gets back to his unit, he'll look after Eddie. And in the meantime, Eddie will be all right. And then they start walking off and he says, do you want to get something at the mess tent? And then BJ says, the specialty today is ambush stew. It'll attack you when you least expect it. And Eddie goes, ambush stew. And he goes, you're funny. And then, and then Hawkeye looks so pissed off. And BJ gives the classic shit-eating grin of like, see?
Even the mentally challenged guy recognizes my humor, recognizes I am the funniest.
What I think is I love that the jealousy really only flows in one direction. It's really only
good point.
It's really only Hawkeye who gets mad at BJ. I think BJ's only doing it because he's just poking at Hawkeye because he can. I don't think Hawkeye cares that. I mean, excuse me. I don't think BJ cares that much about who's the funnier, except for the fact where they specifically ask this question. But I think generally he's not competitive like that. But Hawkeye just is. That's who Hawkeye is. So Winchester and Klinger are back. Margaret is, incensed again about the footlocker. And he says, don't take it out on me. I didn't do anything. Again, it's got to get damaged in combat. And then she talks about that some pervert in the camp has broken into her footlocker, which is very gutsy, right? Because, you know,
when I was 10 watching this episode, I wasn't sure what exactly was going on.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's like somebody broke into my footlocker. Someone violated my footlocker and my things. I know violation when I see it. Like,
yeah,
I'm not sure exactly what she's talking about.
Yeah, but I mean, it's you think about it, if Margaret caught you, you would be in such trouble. So it really is. It's like that episode from a couple seasons ago with the young kid Ham, where he broke into the showers with Margaret was there, and Radar is like, boy, sure got guts. Anybody to kind of pull that on, that is not the one to pull it on. And then so she mentions the person breaking in, and then Winchester says a line, perhaps it's some secret admirer who has trouble expressing himself.
That's one of my favorite lines in MASH. This entire sequence that we're about to see where she blows apart the footlocker is one of my favorite things in all of MASH. When Loretta Swit died, I went on YouTube to find it. And this was my memorial clip I posted on Facebook. This is one of my favorite things in all of MASH. And as a comedy element, it's amazing because can't do anything unless it's damaged in combat. Somebody stole the clothes. Can't do anything unless it's damaged in combat. So you're in a setting of a seemingly impossible situation. It's a MASH unit, right? So Margaret is about to provide her own combat. You know, in an instance where something is impossible, comedic characters have to create their own possibilities. And even better, it's a confluence of two seemingly unrelated plots. Charles is out hunting. Margaret has the footlocker problem. Margaret didn't just reach behind her tent and grab a shotgun like she's Bugs Bunny. You know, the groundwork had been laid, and it is only now that these two unrelated plots converge, and she's able to just do it in, man, just waste that footlocker.
I love how she goes from 60 to zero, because she's screaming and screaming, and then she's like, Major, may I borrow your rifle? Like, she just gets
a lady, always a lady. I may be a soldier, but at heart, I'm a lady.
So she marches in, and then, of course, you hear the gun go off. And I like that when it's a shot of Klinger and Winchester, when the gun goes off, and in the background, out of focus in the background is Kelly with another nurse. And you see them kind of go like jump when they hear it. And then she drags out the footlocker with this amazing story where she's like, there I was in my tent. Suddenly a sniper leaped out and fired two shots. Bang, bang.
Bang,
and she
actually
ducks. She ducks down and tells the story. Without hesitation, my valiant footlocker flung itself in the direct line of fire, sacrificing, giving its life so that I might live. And this kind of gets back to your whole thing about the diegetic comedy. This is Margaret trying to be funny. Right? She's mad, but she's also being ridiculous and telling this ridiculous story. And we don't get a lot of instances of Margaret trying to be funny, but here she's actually trying to be funny, but the way she's telling the story.
Yeah. at the end, where Margaret simply says, you know, don't look at me, I think it's a stupid joke. Even from season one, we said Margaret doesn't have time for anybody's BS. No. She's the head nurse. She's got to get stuff done. You're dressing up and telling jokes means nothing. She doesn't have time for Hawkeye imitating Groucho Marx and dropping pop culture references. I mean, why do you talk like that? She says to him in the Carry On Hawkeye.
And Hawkeye, yes, why are you like this?
Yeah, I spent every Saturday afternoon at the movies when I was growing up. I mean, today you and I would say we watched too much TV as a kid. But yeah, for a serious woman, this is comedy. For a serious woman, she has been pushed to the extreme. I mean, I kept saying success is not funny. You might say, well, wait a minute, she just succeeded. She's going to get a new Foot Locker. She blew it apart. Only because she had to push reality out of the way.
Yes.
You know, she gets her success by, you know, bending the universe to her will, if you will.
All the times I've watched this episode, I don't think I've ever noticed until this one that she does the ducking out of the way, which is very funny. You know, telling the whole story of like ducking out of the way of this imaginary sniper. I think that's really great stuff. So then we join everybody in the O Club, and they are Hawkeye and BJ are telling the joke back to back and getting ratings from Potter and Margaret and Winchester. Now this makes no sense because they've all heard the joke, so it's you're not going to laugh at it again, and you're especially not going to laugh at the same joke told back to back. You know, it's not going to make anybody laugh. And Potter kind of does the, and then they talk about the BJ. You know, Honeycutt has a certain lilt, and then Winchester says, you know, I admit, Pierce, you create the illusion of flight,
admirably.
But Honeycutt brings a wonderful panache, and the way David Ogden Stiers rolls that word out of his tongue, panache. And BJ's like, I've got lilt and panache. Come on, you can't beat that. And then, of course, as you just talked about, Margaret's like, don't get me into this. It's a stupid joke. Nobody can fly by just going. And then she flaps her wings like, so love how literal she's taking it all. Mm-hmm. Now here, everybody's got their backs to the camera, right? So they because the bar's on the other side. It's just a very strange staging. I gotta keep going on about this, but it's just an unusual staging for the O Club to do it this way.
Probably for the crowd in this particular scene.
I guess so. So then they find Klinger, who is writing the letter, and they're asking, who's the funniest guy here, me or BJ? And Klinger's like, it's no contest. And of course, Hawkeye assumes the win there. And he says, neither one of you. And he says, you guys, and I love the way he sort of was like a little, you guys don't even make the first cut. Like he's just kind of, yep. You know, and he says, I'm trying to tell my uncle the kind of place I work in, doctors, nurses, saving lives. And then he just basically reiterates all the plot of the episode. And he's like, all you guys do is go around telling jokes. What's so funny about that? And he mentions about this is why I never got a Section 8. And of course, Hawkeye and BJ are not thrilled with that answer, and they get up and they walk away because that's not the answer they wanted.
And story-wise, he brought all of the elements together in Klinger's letter and his twist on it. None of this funny.
Yeah.
Like, you guys are not funny. The reality is, which is the whole point of MASH, I guess, the reality is stranger than the fiction. The reality is the funnier or weirder or crazier element.
Yeah. So then they go up to Father Mulcahy, who has finished his song, and he sings this ballad about the war. And I don't like this song. I think this song is kind of turgid a little, except for the line about, with all the pain and death this madness brings, which is very evocative, right? I like that line a lot. But it's, I don't know, I sort of like the other song more. I know that the whole point of this is like, oh, this is the good one. But because they show everybody and everyone is looking, you know, oh, wow, we're hearing, they're really being emotionally whopped by this. And it even ends on a kind of treacly way with Hawkeye saying amen, you know. But I don't know. I kind of like the other one a little more than this.
This is a downer. It has to be a downer. This is how jokes end in failure. You know, the guy's third wish is never going to be the thing that brings him happiness. And if MASH is about war, as I said, we've been using humor diegetically to try to deal with war, but in the end, here we are. It's madness and death and horrible stuff.
Yeah, the song's never going to be hit by all the pain and death this madness brings. It's never going to go anywhere. So that's the end of the main part of the episode. And then we come back into the showers, and Hawkeye and BJ are kind of declaring a truce that they thought it was a little silly. In fact, they're talking about Hank and Eddie and how they got along, and they realize, you know, we should endeavor to not be so, you know, stupid towards each other. And, you know, they declare a truce. And then we see Hawkeye shaving, and then he turns around, and we see that he shaved everything but the hair on his upper lip. So now he's got a mustache, and he points to it, and that's the end of our episode.
Now that you've seen the episode, go back and rewatch it. Now, Alan Alda is frequently unshaven, and you know, as Hawkeye. But watch the upper lip, as you know, the 3 or 4 days this episode was filmed, and I think it looks particularly a little shaggier, and the eyebrows too. I mean, I think he obviously did grow it out, but
yes,
pay attention as you're rewatching the episode. Wait a minute, that is a little bit more of a mustache than usual. Interesting.
Yeah,
and of course, it's a mustache, right? The Groucho thing, the mustache, the eyebrows, the thing, of all the things you're going to make fun of for a comedy episode, for an episode about jokes, of course a mustache.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen Alan Alda. Oh, wait, no. I take it back. He did a movie in the 80s that he wrote and directed called A New Life, or A New Leaf? A New Life? A New Life. A New Life with Anne Margaret. And he's got a beard and a mustache in that one.
Does he have a mustache in Four Seasons?
No.
Or same time next year. Maybe think of same time next year.
No? Does he? I have not seen that movie in decades, so I don't remember. But I'm just, I don't recall seeing him with a mustache hardly
ever. He's not a mustache guy.
Hardly ever. So it is a little bit unusual thing. And then that's the end of our episode. So one thing I wanted to mention before we get off this is that I was looking, you know, as I do, I go through IMDb and look and see if there's anything worth noting here. And someone left this comment regarding the whole Foot Locker thing for Margaret. And this is what they wrote. Because remember, this is supposed to be trivia, everybody. This is supposed to be kind of like factual stuff. As, quote, as any problem Major Houlihan has, she handles it in her own demeaning, personally abusive way. All the main cast have similar traits. Living in a war zone isn't a song and dance. There's one guy out there who had like who really doesn't like Margaret Houlihan,
beef.
And he's
beef.
Like, this is the episode. I'm logging in. I'm creating an account on IMDb. I'm creating a handle just to write that. I'm really mad. So he's probably some incel somewhere on Twitter right now. But that
he
jumped out of me.
I'm
like, what? Like, why is he? Yeah, he's like a Foot Locker salesman or something. Like, what is, what a weird thing. So yeah, there you go. But anyway, that is Dear Uncle Abdul. I like this episode quite a bit. It is a ragtag collection of things, but as you pointed out, Kevin, it hangs together a little more than you might expect. And I like the serious plotline. And Margaret's whole thing is really funny. That whole sequence with her is terrific.
That's a top 5 all of MASH sequence for me. It's become a family joke. We did the great MASH rewatch during COVID, and my kids would watch on their lunch breaks, and I'd go down every now and then. And at first, I sort of forgot. I remembered this episode partially, but at first I sort of forgot. And then as soon as the Foot Locker was mentioned, we all looked at each other like, oh my God, it's the Foot Locker episode. And when she blows apart, it's just so incredibly funny. Something you usually mention, I don't know. What scene is usually cut or was cut from syndication? Do you know?
You know, this must have been one of the ones that they just trimmed it like a couple of seconds per scene, because there is no big scene that I don't remember seeing in syndication.
Yeah, I remember seeing all of these. Yeah, I remember seeing this episode every single bit. Yeah, unless they cut the button at the end. I don't know.
No. I mean, there isn't any part of this that I am like, oh, I don't remember that whole chunk. So they must have just very, very subtly cut transitions here and there. So I prefer those edits than the wholesale, you know, removal of like a 4-minute scene or something like that. But yeah. So, okay. Do you have a favorite line or joke from this episode?
I think that, like I said, the whole Foot Locker scene is amazing. I think the phrase, I just love that phrase. I love Charles's bit about, you know, you created that wondrous anecdote, no, but I own the North Korean rights to it. I think that's just so clever. That's such a lovely turn of phrase. It's so witty and clever. I love that.
I do love the idea of the rights to something, right? That's not something we, like, most people think about, like the rights to something. And now, well, actually, we're all living in that now, thanks to streaming channels, right? Because now I think before streaming, the average person didn't know about rights to a movie. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't know, who owned a movie. And now we've all gotten an education on, oh, well, that's a Disney movie, so you can only get it on Disney Plus, and that's a Warner Brothers movie, so you get it. Like, we've all gotten an education on streaming rights, unfortunately.
And IP,
an IP, yeah, exactly.
My
favorite joke is when Hawkeye and BJ learned about Eddie for the first time, and they say, you know, Dave says he's just a little slow, and then Hawkeye says, what the hell is a kid like that doing in combat? With BJ responding, maybe there are no openings on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which...
Jump up.
Love that joke. This, the disgust that he has for the people that have sent him there. I just think it's a bitter gag, but it's a great gag. I like that line quite a bit. So that is Dear Uncle Abdul, Kevin. So any other theories you want to regale us with before we sign off?
No, I think I've gone as far as I can possibly go, but I want to remind everybody, I'll be at the Chuckle Hut in Schenectady on Thursday. And on Saturday, I'll be in Kalamazoo, where I'm opening for Weird Al.
It's funny. K-sounds are always funny.
K-sounds are always funny.
Exactly.
So I hope everybody listening wants to sit down now and become a professional television comedy writer. Because if you watch MASH, it's obviously easy. It's effortless.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
I mean, anybody can do this. This stuff writes itself. The two writers on this are absolutely top-notch guys. Even if they're working from a bulletin board and other people's ideas. Beautifully structured, beautifully strung together, and it's funny.
It is.
We're trying to be funny.
They should have kept doing these every season. I don't get why Margaret never got one. Or who did we establish? So Frank never got one. And Margaret never got one, and Henry never got one. I think that was it, right? Though everybody else, because there's Dear Sis.
I've done like five of these. I did Dear Sis.
Yeah, Dear Sis was Mulcahy. This one's Klinger. Multiple Dear Dads. There was Dear Peggy for BJ. There was the bulletin board was kind of a Dear Becky one for Trapper, because he's writing a letter to his child.
Right. I did Radar's report, which I said was a Dear I-Corps episode.
Dear Ma is Radar. Dear Mildred was Potter. Dear Sigmund. So Sidney Friedman got one, for Pete's sake. It's a crime that Margaret never got one.
But let's talk about this. Who is funnier exactly? And why exactly is it BJ of the two? I think BJ is funnier simply because, as we saw in Dear Sigmund, he is, again, unexpected. He's Hawkeye is in your face. Yeah, yes. I'm being funny. But nobody expects BJ to be the practical joker. So nobody expects laconic, mellow BJ to turn loose with crazy bird stuff and things like that. I think overall, BJ may be the funnier simply because he's so unexpected.
If I may, I think that dynamic that I mentioned earlier when I was in high school, I think that was the dynamic that my friend and I had, was that he was the Hawkeye and I was the BJ. I was a little quieter with the joke, but I think, you know, I'm complimenting myself because BJ is my favorite character. But I think that was – he was more outwardly funny and wacky, kind of. And I was a little more like kind of quiet, and then boom, could do that kind of thing. So I think at least, again, that's what at least I tell myself. So, okay, Kevin, thank you once again, my friend. I always enjoy talking
always
to
pleasure.
You and it's always great having you on the show. So thank you for coming back once again.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So do you want to tell people where they can find you out on LiveJournal or whatever it is?
If you've got an Emac or anything else that will run Netscape Navigator, you can go over to kevinlauderdale.livejournal.com, and I will try to have a page up for you to spend your few pennies downloading some of my funny stories in cheap anthologies. If you've enjoyed what you've listened to, this is a sort of humor. No, ideally the stuff I write is a lot funnier than the stuff I say, because I'm just not that funny a guy, really. I mean,
you really know how to sell it. So yeah. You've got a wonderful panache, though, Kevin. So...
So, I'm not sure about my lilt. I tend to sound like Sylvester the Cat sometimes. Yeah.
So thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of MASHcast on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. You can find me on Blue Sky under Rob Kelly Creative. And finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big salute to Dennis Bailey, Daryl Clark, James K., Michael Kelly, David Mann, Matt McLean, Lisa P., Brady Palmer, Joe Perino, Stan Peel, Michael Porter, Nicholas Prom, Adam Sanders, Stefan Van Schaik, Britt Schramm, Billy Schumann, and Mike Thomas. Thank you so much, everybody. So thanks all for listening. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
What I have in there is a foot opener, and some disgusting deviant in this camp has done just that. Opened it. Violated my personal, private, intimate belongings.
The Major wouldn't be imagining things, would she?
Klinger, I know violating when I see it.